Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Wonders of the Night Sky You Must See Before You Die. Now, we're not doing episodes, we're just doing the actual wonders themselves. We're up to wonder number 34, Supermoons. And this is by Bob King. And it's actually quite a good author, and it's actually affecting the way that I write. So it's good, but it's an awesomely long time to read through. Now, this is Supermoons. The moon is full every month, but not all full moons are equal in distance, the size and brightness. So this is just for me. The word month means a moonth. Yeah, that's strange. If the moon's orbit around the Earth were an exact circle, it would be. But the moon's orbit is imperfect, or squashed circle, called an ellipse. One end of the ellipse is called the perigee. The moon is closest to the Earth. The other one is called the apogee, the farthest. It passes the perigee and apogee points once every 27.5 days, the time it takes the moon to orbit the Earth. While the moon's average distance from the Earth is around 384,600 kilometres, at the perigee it's more like 225,000 miles, or 3,062,000 kilometres. The perigee, the moon field, appears bigger and brighter than average. At apogee, the moon backs off to about 405,000 kilometres and looks smaller and fainter. So just have it there. So obviously the astronauts waited to go there. So this orbit is a month, but it's where that month tracks the where that orbit is in relation to the sun. Supermoon occurs when full moons happens in the perigee. A typical supermoon is around 7% bigger and 16% brighter than average of a full moon, because it's inverse square, you know. Let's see, yeah, it's inverse square, so it's the square. Well, it's that the actual brightness is pretty much the same, because it's this, you know, it's the brightness, you know, from the sun to the moon to the Earth, so that distance doesn't change very much. But the area of the moon is much bigger. And during an unusually close perigee, the moon can be 12 to 14% larger and 30% brighter than an apogee full moon. The term supermoon is a recent invention. It came into common use in 2011, but appears to have been coined back in 1979 by Richard Knoll, who describes himself as a certified professional astrologer. His definition of a supermoon in his book Horoscope was generous: a new or full moon which occurs with the moon at or near within 90% of the closest approach to the Earth at a given orbit. The opposite, so it's really a supermoon, is just a new term, I didn't grow up with it, is an apogee moon called a mini or micro moon. No one celebrates these smaller than average moons. Like TV, most of us prefer full moons large. Now, what is it? Now, the two blue moons, the two moons in a month is called a blue moon. Now, with one and occasionally two full moons a month, it's not surprising that we get at least a few supermoons every year. In 2018, there were two, both January, because the second full moon in the month is nicknamed Blue Moon. The Lucky Sky Watchers witnessed a super blue moon at the month, at the end of the year. Yes, it is a nickname, I suppose. Some supermoons are more super than others. If the full moon occurs within a few hours of perigee, the supermoon will be a bit closer, bigger, brighter, and the supermoon occurring plus or minus a day of perigee. Other factors also come into play that draw the moon in closer yet. I wonder what that is. When a full moon arrives at a perigee point, it makes a neat line-up of the Earth and the Sun. both of which are gravitational heavyweights. The Sun, in particular, holds sway over the Moon, despite its much greater distance. It's far more massive than the Earth, and its gravitational grip is about twice as strong. The neat alignment of the three bodies shifts the Moon's orbit slightly, the Earth's Sun direction moving the perigee a little bit closer to the Earth. But we're still not finished. If a supermoon occurs during late fall through midwinter, when the Earth is closer to the Sun, the extra bit of solar tug that will bring the Moon even closer. So we're a little bit... I suppose it's not just pure orbital mechanics there. I suppose it's really complicated to talk about. But indeed, Australia is closer to the Sun in summer. So our summer is shorter and hotter. All this, and this is why your equinox are different from your solstices. The difference, the distance from solstice to equinox are different. They're not exactly a quarter of a year. Equinox is the point where the axis of the Earth is pointing, sort of, it's not pointing it's pointing at an angle, but not an angle towards the axis of the skew. I suppose the word would be termed perfectly skew, might be the word. I sort of know what I'm talking about there. All these things conspire to bring November's 2016 full moon just 508 kilometres from Earth, equal to half the Earth's diameter, than a typical perigee. Many of us at the time couldn't resist calling it the super duper moon. 2016 was the last exceptionally close perigee. Next occurs in November 25th, 2034. Okay, well, I think I might try and be alive for that time. Wouldn't be unreasonable to be alive for that long. While differences in the Moon distance are significant, so you can really tell if the Moon looks larger without measuring a device. After all, we can't drive into a mini-moon and plunk it next to the supermoon. We either have to recall the average appearance of a full moon or compare it with our mind's eye or find a way to measure the distance. Some observers have excellent recollection and abilities and can clearly see the difference. Others, like me, require help. That's why I cooked up a little device I called the Supermoon Sighter that provides at least a rough measure of the Moon's apparent size using just the naked eye. With a pair of scissors, cut a series of slots of varying width in an index card and hold the card as best you can parallel to your face at the maximum width of your arm facing the Moon. Close one eye and use the other determine the slot into which the Moon fits snugly. Be sure to ink and date the time under the slot. I suppose what I would be done is just a V, and you see where the V touches and note the date there. That would be good. Yeah, that's what the way I do. Tuck the card in place, you'll remember, and bring it out again and compare the Moon's size at apogee. Repeat the procedure until you see what slot the Moon fits into this time. While conducting your experiment, you'll find it easier to see the slots if the Moon is viewed in a twilight sky. Unrelated to the supermoon is the inflating apparent size of all the more the Moon is the illusion. Around moonrise, moonset, when the full Moon hovers the horizon, we've all seen that huge orange globe. What makes it so? In daily experience, an object off towards the horizon like an aeroplane or flight and geese is generally farther away, those directly above us. But for extraterrestrial bodies such as the Moon, Sun, and constellation, which are identical in size whether or not on the horizon or the zenith, we have no reference. Therefore, we gaze at the horizontal Moon, which clearly lies beyond every object in the foreground. Our brains assume it must be further away than overhead version. We compensate this for the perception of inflating the moon's size. In a sense, our brains force the moon to meet the expectation of how big it should be. Well, you want to put... In reality, a rising setting moon is slightly farther away and a tiny bit smaller than when it's overhead, because we have to look across the curvature of the Earth and then out to the moon. When it's up high, there's no Earth in the way, so we're a little bit closer to the moon. The difference amounts to only 1.5%. It is an overwhelming effect, by the effect of the moon. So, the lunar dark side, I rather like that. So this is 25, and how many minutes are we in? Sorry, I've got to... Oh, we're 10 minutes in, so mercifully short, 35. Even if you live in a big city, you'll get an eye full of earth shine, so long as you can spot the waving, the waxing crescent of the moon at dusk and the waning moon at dawn. Sunlight has a way, has ways of getting around, and one of them is by reflection. I love the way that's done. So I'm drinking my soup, which is probably the worst podcast etiquette possible. But you know, you're at home with me. Objects close to the sun not only feel the heat more intensely, all things being equal, they appear brighter too. We see the moon and planets just because they reflect sunlight, otherwise they would be invisible. Shut down the sun and the planets would wink out in order of distance from the Earth. First the moon, then the inner planets, and lastly Neptune. Sorry, I just saw the Brian Cox on Pluto, and that was a fantastic shot. When the moon returns to the western sky at dusk, sunlight illuminates the bottom edge and we see the thin crescent. But even a casual glance will show there's something more going on there. The entire outline of the moon, though it looks grey and faint, for generations people have called the old man, the old moon and the new moon arms. Oh dear. Sukrin is a delightfully poetic way to describe earthlight. Sunlight, which reflects off the earth, onto the moon and back again to our eyes. The earth is no perfect mirror. Sometimes the sunlight is absorbed by water and ground. Only a portion reflects back to space. When it reaches the moon, 1.3 seconds later, the dark lunar soil greedily absorbs much of the Earth's reflected light and sends back only a little in return. The two reflections journey some 772,500 kilometres, only two moon distances. Only a modest trickle remains. The reason Earth-lit moon looks faint and ghostly compared to sunlit crescent. Imagine you're an astronaut standing somewhere on Earth-lit moon. Ground illumination would resemble a deep twilight here on Earth. The stars shining bright and steadily on the black sky overhead. Among them, brighter and bigger than anything else in the heavens, Earth would shine down. No wonder you can see the landscape so clearly. When the moon's crescents back to the Earth up to the moon, the astronauts see a nearly full Earth hanging in the sky. Just as the moon, just at the same time, the moon. The Earth is nearly four times the full moon's appearance in diameter and 50 times brighter. Four squared is 16, but it's probably got a better reflection. The Earth and Moon phases complement each other. When we see a lunar crescent, our alter ego on the Moon sees a gibbous Earth. That's a nearly full Earth. When the Moon is half, the Earth is half, and when the Moon is full, the Earth is a skinny crescent. As the crescent Moon waxes, the Earth wanes in the Moon's sky. Light reflected to our planet is delivered to the Moon, lessens curse causing Earth shine to fade. That's that, and the Moon's own increasing brightness fills
as it fills out, makes it difficult to see Earth shine beyond half-moon phase. If you make a point to look at it, the Earth shine is visible up to 5 days past the new moon without optical aid. Binoculars and a small telescope extends that to about 8 days. My personal best is 9 days past with a 10-inch at 250mm telescope. While using binoculars or telescope, place the glary half of the moon out of the field of view and let your eyes better see the much weaker Earth shine. When the crescent is thin, take some time to roam the lunar twilight zone with a telescope or binoculars. You'll spy half a dozen or more lunar seas and bright rays craters, Tycho, Copernicus, Arisicus. There's a moon called Hell after a Hungarian astronomer called Peter Hill. And Peter Hill, it sounds like an Irish person or American trying to say my name. While Earth's shine is visible any time, the moon crescent, northern hemisphere observers will see it best at dusk in the spring months and at dawn and fall. Then the crescent stands highest in the sky, at least affected by the horizon haze. Because the brightness of the Earth's shine depends primarily on the Earth's cloud cover, variation in density may help us understand changes in our planet's climate. Earth and moon share an ancient bond. According to the prevailing theory, the moon originated in a catastrophic collision between Mars-sized planet and early Earth 4.5 billion years ago. The impactor and a good chunk of the planet were pulverized into molten hail of rock and dust that later coalesced into the moon. Seeing the light touch the Earth on the lunar landscape reminds us of the deep connection between our two worlds. Oh dear. And I'll take a break for a second. Number 36, Uranus and Neptune. Which, you know, quite honestly, Uranus, besides having an odd... I think, which one's got Triton? I'll probably go refer to it. Uranus would have to be the most featureless, boring, illicit planet ever. Neptune's at least got a cloud in it, and it's hotter for some reason. Just trying to think. Uranus's moon is Triton, is Uranus's, or Neptune Triton's. I've got to remember what it was. You may have glimpsed these in binoculars when you took the challenge of seeing eight planets at one night. Now you'll want to see these cold, remote worlds up close through a telescope. Close is a humorous term when it comes to astronomy. Depending on your perspective, close could be anywhere from a quarter of a million miles away to 26 trillion miles, the distance to Alpha Centauri. The closest star system, or 2.5 million light years, the distance to Andromeda, one of the closest galaxies. See what I mean? Uranus and Neptune lie 2.8 and 4.5 billion kilometers from the Sun. So, it's really, Neptune is, you know, twice as far out, and both are nearly four times bigger than the Earth. Astronomers call them ice giants, in contrast to the gas giants of Jupiter and Saturn. Ice giants are composed primarily of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, which are rich in water, ammonia, and methane ices. Methane is the colourless gas most of us know as natural gas and commonly used to heat our homes. Because it's odourless, the gas producers add an odorant to help us alert us to potential leaks. Cows produce lots of methane through belching and flatulence. But whatever that smells like isn't methane's fault. Composed of carbon and hydrogen, methane colours both plants lovely shades of aquamarine and blue. Aquamarine is for the Uranus, and Neptune is dark blue. The gas condenses into a bitter cold atmosphere of its clouds that absorb red light, reflect back blue. When you point a small telescope at either of these planets and crank it up to magnification of 100 or 150, each becomes a tiny blue dot. Uranus looks like the size of a pea head, and Neptune a little larger than a period at the end of this sentence. If nothing else, seeing them through the eyepiece gives you a sense of how remote they are. It also gives you a new respect for William Herschel, an English astronomer who stumbled across Uranus on March 13, 1781, because almost everyone considered the number of planets to be settled at six. The idea was a new one. It wasn't the first thing to cross the mind. Herschel feared that there must be either a comet or an unresolved double star. Further observations by him and other astronomers showed the object for it was the first of a new planet discovered since antiquity. Now, that's the discovery of a new planet was another sort of earthquake moment for science. To bolster your hope of finding the planet, Herschel made his discovery using a 157mm telescope. With a map showing where to look, you should be able to nab it with binoculars. Uranus became a bit of an embarrassment because irregularities in the orbital motion suggested the gravity of another, more distant body was to blame. Two mathematicians, Urbain Verrier in France and John Couch Adams in England, took up the task of calculating the position of hypothetical planets based on the anomalies. Working the Verrier's calculations, German astronomers Johann Gottfried Geil peered through the telescope at the Berlin Observatory on the night of September 23rd and 24th, 1846, ticking off stars as a predicted position, hoping to find one that wasn't supposed to be there. To his disbelief, he hit upon one just after midnight, less than 1 degree from Verrier's predicted position. Contemporary physicist Francois Argo cleverly summed up the remarkable discovery, crediting Le Verrier as a man who discovered the planet with a point of his pen. Both blue-eyed planets are visible binoculars. Through a telescope, is really the way to go. They'll show you disks of colours, things that you won't see with ordinary binoculars. Because they're far from the sun, the chilly worlds move slowly across the sky, Uranus completing an orbit every 84 years and Neptune every 165 years. Think about that for a moment. Uranus goes around in the same time it takes one of us to go around in this lifetime. Neptune, meanwhile, only has it completed a bit more of one orbit since its discovery. The charts will point you to the planets through 2018-19 observing season. You can also make your own final map with Stellarium. Tip of the phone apps, remember to zoom in so you can see all the stars of similar brightness around either planet. Just like Gale, you need to eliminate them to be sure you're looking at the planet, not a star. If you doubt the planet's identity when using a telescope, increase the magnification. Stars look like tiny points and small spikes, while planets clearly formed disks. Okay, 37, the crescent of Venus, which is what Galileo looked like. So that's interesting there. I really have to go with Triton. Is it Neptune's, or I think it's Uranus's moon Triton travels the opposite direction. It's also interesting about the shepherding of rings. At some point in our busy lives, on the way to work, school, or waiting for a line at the landfill, we're momentarily distracted by the sight of a brilliant star in the twilight sky. Well, certainly it was Venus. No other starlight object shines steadily and bright. None will until the day that's long overdue supernova. For now, it has no competition. I must admit, I have embarrassed myself saying, "There's a supernova!" And then people say, "Oh, that's Venus." Because the second planet from the Sun orbits inside the Earth's orbit, we periodically get to see it pass between us and the Sun. As you demonstrated for yourself by taking a ball and holding it between you and a bright light source, no light reaches the side of the ball facing you. But if you move the ball to the left or right, the source of light, some of the light now shines along the rim in a shape of a crescent. That's the shape you'll get in the side light of the spherical object, and demonstrated why Venus, just like the Moon, goes through phases. To visualize other phases, imagine you have three friends standing in a circle at 190 degrees, a quarter of a circle apart. A lamp representing the sun shines in the center. You're holding a big white ball, the planet Venus, directly in front of you. And it blocks out the light to the lamp. Before you see the unlit side of Venus, one in the illustration, if you move the ball slightly to the right, the crescent illuminates the left and right edge. If you move to the left, the crescent appears on the right. Now, toss the ball to a friend to the right. That's beautifully put. When he or she holds the ball out towards lamp number two, from the perspective, half is lit. You see a full moon Venus when it's tossed to number four. Congratulations, you've just put Venus through all phases. If you'd paid close attention, you'd have noticed that when Venus was close to you, its new crescent faces. It looked larger compared to a full moon Venus, which was at the opposite side of the lamp, farther away. As in our experiments, so in real life, when Venus is a crescent, it appears much bigger than anywhere else along its orbit. So big, if you don't even need a telescope to see its shape. Binoculars magnified just 7 or 10 will turn the star-like planet into an exquisite little crescent moon. The other phases are also fun to see, but only the crescent is close enough and large enough to be easily discerned with the binoculars. For the best views, I recommend looking at the planet in twilight before it gets too dark. And that way, you'll avoid Venus's glare, which makes it tougher to see its shape. The evening crescent opens left or east exactly like the waxing crescent in the moon and evening sky. The morning crescent opens up to the right or west like the waning crescent of the moon. Occasionally, both crescent moon and crescent Venus will be seen in conjunction, and we get that rare treat of seeing two crescents at once. Okay, well, I'll finish this off and put this out to pasture. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.